This is an interview with Mr. Kenneth D. Weber at his home on Lincoln Avenue for the Youngstown State University Oral History Department. The date is October 13th, 1982, and the interviewer is Stephen G. Papoulos. The topic is for the Niles, a history of the Niles Police Department. Mr. Weber, can you tell me how old you are today?
75.
75?
Right.
How long have you lived in Niles?
Since the summer of 27.
1927.
And I came right from Ohio State here for my first coaching and teaching job.
Where were you born?
Pardon?
Where were you born?
In Galena, Ohio, that's in Delaware County.
And did you have any brothers or sisters?
No, I'm an only child.
Mm-hmm. How about your own parents? Where did your dad and mom come from?
My dad had lived in the Columbus area all of his life, and but his background was German. And for example, I remember that he did not want to go to school as a little boy because they were sending him to German school, and he didn't think that was right.
Mm-hmm. And what about your mom?
My mother is a graduate of Ohio State in the class of 02.
It's pretty good.
Way back.
Yeah. Coming from Galena, what sort of things can you remember reaching back in your memory about high school?
Well, in the first place, Galena is a very, very small town, and still about the same size. But we didn't live on a farm. We lived right in town. But it was agricultural all around it, a lot of orchards as well as regular agricultural endeavors. But we had a rather surprising thing that we just seemed to have one of those things that happens in a small town occasionally, a bunch of great, big, well-coordinated boys. And we were absolutely terrific in athletics for 4 or 5 years with this group. And we had a coach that was pretty sharp. He started in when we were just coming into high school and would schedule one tough team and then the rest of them easier ones. The next year he scheduled 3 or 4, and finally, the last year that I played, we didn't play anything but big schools.
How did you do?
Won them all.
Is that right?
Great big fellows.
That's all right. So,
for example, I had a backfield with a fullback that weighed over 200 pounds and was fast. And one halfback would go about 185, and the other one about 165, and then there was me. And I was playing at about 145.
What position were you?
I was a quarterback.
Outstanding. What did your dad do for a living if he wasn't a farmer?
He had a little creamery in the town for a while, and then eventually he sold that to an outfit in Columbus for the exchange of going in there to be the superintendent of that dairy. And then gradually he merged with more and more until he had the nucleus of what is now Borden Dairies.
In other words, he was the one who really began Borden Dairies.
No, Borden was an Eastern outfit.
Mm-hmm.
But Borden came out and dealt with him eventually and got a merger going.
Good. He must have been a real businessman. Good person. Good mind.
Well, he got along well with people, and in my estimation, he was a tremendous supervisor, and continually thinking of his men. That's the name of the game.
Sure is. That's right. What did you do in Ohio State? Did you play any of your athletic sports there?
Yeah, I was down there to be their quarterback, and I got ruined freshman year and didn't get to play more football. Much to my mother's pleasure, but I played 3 years of basketball and 3 years of track.
Mm-hmm. What possessed you to come to Niles, Ohio?
Dr. Basil had played football at Ohio State, and he was down to see the athletic director at Ohio State and needed another coach. And so the athletic director called me up at the fraternity house and said, "I think we have a job for you." I said, "That's fine." I said, "What about this fellow? Does he know how old I am?" He said, "Yep." I said, "I told him how old you are. It doesn't matter to him because I had been that senior year since I wasn't able to play football. They'd shoved me over, and I was assistant freshman football coach, and coached backs on the freshman squad. And because that sounds good, and was terrific experience, because I had coaching experience that most fellows didn't have coming out of school."
What year was that you came to Niles?
The fall of 27.
And how old would you have been?
19.
Only 19 years old, and you were coaching in Niles.
And Frank Lux was captain of the team that year, and we had a mighty good ball club.
What kind of man was Frank Lux as a student in school?
He did an odd... Well, things had gotten tough in their family, and Frank dropped out of school 1 year. The year before I came, he had not been in school because he needed to work. They were having some financial reverses in their family. Then the next year, Frank came back to school, played ball, graduated, and I arranged for him to get down to Ohio State. He played and won letters for three straight years. He played a guard at Ohio State and was quite good. He played for Sam Willoughby.
Is that the only sport you coached in Niles?
Just football? No, you coached everything in those days. Now, they had not had anything except football and basketball. And in football, the two coaches had been fired, and they knew they were going to be. And consequently, they didn't do a thing about developing any material. Now, in football, that isn't as serious a matter. You can build football players faster than you can basketball players. A basketball player has to work on instantaneous reflexes. In football, you call a play and you know what you're going to do and you do it. But in basketball, we had a real tough time trying to get back because there wasn't anyone left from an all victorious team the year before. The team had been really good, but they'd all graduated.
Right. Well, this is interesting. I've never been able to interview a person who I might say came from the outside. You don't seem, in other words, to have deep family roots, as some have, for generations in town. And so the next question I want to ask you, what was your first impression of Niles? What did you think when you came in?
One of the most interesting introductions to a town you could ever have, I think, because here I was, 19 years old, coming from Columbus, which was absolutely bone dry during Prohibition. And when Dr. Basil picked me up at the railroad station and said, "Well, we're going to have dinner with the superintendent, but before we pick him up, you and I'll stop at Louis the Owl's for a drink." We go over to Louis the Owl's, we're on Mason Street, and the boys are passing drinks back. They're standing a couple deep at least at the bar and passing drinks back over their shoulders to each other. And of course, I was not being used to being around any liquor. I proceeded to get it up to my lips a couple of times and finally put the glass down, and we get on about picking up the superintendent. But we went down to the Ohio Hotel. It was brand new, and it was the place to eat in those days. Had our discussion, and then later on that evening, Mr. Kiefer took me around town, and I met the various members of the board, and everybody decided that they thought maybe it'd be a good thing to have me in Niles, and so I was here.
Mm-hmm. Louis the Owls. How do you spell O-W-L?
Yeah.
Apostrophe S, like an animal?
Mm-hmm.
Where
you know how all of us felt? I don't even remember where it was. Some of these old timers around here will know where it is. I don't remember because I was fresh in town and we just drove over there at night and I wasn't very well oriented.
Mm-hmm. What other places did you learn existed in Niles on the East End?
Well, of course, very shortly you got acquainted with Jim Jennings, who was the top bootlegger, and he had later built the hall that is over there on Mason Street now, but at that time he had a much smaller place there and so on. But it was interesting because he sent two of his boys over to see me the first week I was here.
For what reason?
Wanted to know if I would could furnish them with a point spread on the games. And I told the boys, I said, "Evans fellows, I don't know any of the teams around here, don't know any of the personnel of these teams around, and I'm not going to be able to make any judgments to amount to anything. That I'll tell you what we'll do, that if you want to know whether anybody, who's hurt, and who is, and who's ready to play, and who's okay, and so on, be glad to let you know on Wednesday or Thursday." And Jim called me on the phone later, and that was great. That was all the information that they wanted.
You mean the games that Niles would play?
Yeah.
Well, how would you know what the point spread? You would have an idea of how strong
I had no idea. That was what I told them. I couldn't make any estimate. But I could tell them if any of our boys were hurt. Because if we were hurt, we weren't going to do as well as we would if everybody was in good shape, of course.
That's right.
My sinus isn't helping much.
Yeah. Can you tell me a little bit more about Jim Jennings?
Particularly during the Depression was when Jim Jennings really came to the front. Because my first thing about the Depression that I remember was that I used to weigh and measure the boys at least the beginning of the end of the school year. And then over the summer, you had a chance to look to see how much they'd grown and so on and so on. But came back there along about 31, I guess it was, 30, 31, and my heavens, the boys had lost weight or hadn't gained any. And so I rushed my information down to Mr. Kiefer, the superintendent, and showed him, and the next day he had collected a whole bunch of mothers, and they came to school. Jen just set up trestle boards with horses down the hall, and they were busy serving soup and sandwiches to the kids, and kept on doing that all the way through the Depression. But as far as Jim was concerned, if you had any kids that didn't have shoes or clothes to go to school, all you had to do was call Jim up, let him know, and he'd call you back in about 10 minutes and say, "Send them down to this store or that store," and said, "I have told them that they are to have shoes or clothes or whatever they needed." That fellow must have spent thousands and thousands of dollars on kids' clothes there during the Depression.
What did he look like? Tell me a little bit about the man. He's very interesting to me because so many people talk about him.
He's hard to describe, really is. He was kind of an round-faced and a little bit raw-boned with high cheekbones and of course he had a lot of Italian touch to his voice because when he was a kid at home they spoke Italian at home, and so his English wasn't the best, but he was sure an interesting character. But you know, when you think about Prohibition and that day, that anybody in the valley here, the men working in the mills weren't at least in the favor of Prohibition at all, because you know, the awful hard work they put in, and there were no showers to get cleaned up and so on before they went home. And most of those fellows would stop and have themselves a quick one or two on their way home because they were well nigh exhausted coming out of the hot mill, and they needed it. And far as that's concerned, Jim was just supplying a need.
Mm-hmm. It's a good way of putting it, too. Did he have any problems with the Black Hand?
I don't know. Because that was the sort of thing, you know, that was quiet, and I don't know.
What are some other outstanding moments you might remember with Jim Jennings?
Well, I remember that Jim was terrifically interested in sports of all kind, and he had a girls' basketball team that he had recruited around the valley, and his outstanding star was a girl, a big, tall girl, the name of Susie Sponseller from Leavittsburg, and she was absolutely terrific. I think she could have played on any boys' team around the valley and done well.
Hmm. Did you ever go into the Jennings nightclub?
No, and being in the education business, it was just something you didn't do.
What other times did you get to talk to the man? You said that you found him interesting. In what ways? Can you give me examples?
Well, largely because you could see that basically he was a very sound businessman. And he ran a tight ship. And of course he had to, because he had some boys that were a little rough to handle. Some of his boys that were running rum down from either Buffalo or Port Clinton, wherever the shipments came in. He was handling a lot of bonded liquor that was being imported from Canada. Good, really good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then,
who are some of the people around him?
Well, let's see, Marty Flask was one of his boys. Marty was an interesting character because he had a raccoon coat, and Jim had furnished his boys with Chrysler convertibles at that time. They were the fastest thing on the road. And so when they were breaking, of course, they had the springs worked on so they could handle a good heavy load in the trunk without the back sagging so that anybody would notice and pick them up. Let's see. I'm having trouble trying to think of a name now. I'm not going to get it either. The fellow that got into the argument with Marty and shot Marty.
Mango.
Yeah, Chippy Mango. Lived right up here on the next block.
What kind of guy was Chippy?
Chippy was a real, real good boy. Now, Marty had quite a reputation of being a lady killer, and people in town that were pretty unhappy with him, but Chippy just tended to do his business, but they got into some sort of an argument one night. Chippy went home and got his shotgun, and that was that. Chippy left town. They didn't find him for years and years. When they did find him and brought him back, as I understand, they picked him up through the IRS, and when they brought him back to town, everybody that knew anything about the case was dead, and so they just turned him loose.
Hmm. How interesting.
To tell you the truth about it, a lot of the people thought it was good riddance to...
Yeah, the guy who got shot?
Yeah.
I take it he was an unpopular type person.
Yeah.
What was he like, a short little man?
Or? No, he was about 5'10" and slender, good looking, and he was a killer with the gals. There was that raccoon coat and so on. And I was talking with one of the older ladies the other day, and she said, you know, I worked down such and such a place downtown, and Marty would go past in the convertible and said, we would wave, because he'd wave at us and said, we'd wave back very quietly. Nobody would notice. Said our parents would have killed us if they thought we were waving back at Marty. Oh, boy.
What, was Marty in charge of anything in particular?
He was just one of his drivers.
One of the drivers?
Yeah. He and Chippy, as I remember, were the two main drivers.
Was Chippy, did he have any other responsibility in particular?
I don't think so.
Mm-hmm. What was he like?
Awfully hard to remember. It's been so far back. And he was gone from town so long.
Yeah. Who else was around the Jenningses?
Well, of course, Jim's brother.
Joe?
Joe was there.
Well, what do you remember?
He was the one, you know, that had the beer distribution place down in Girard on the other side of town, remember?
Yeah.
And Jim and Joe were an awful lot alike, just real nice, basic fellows that... They didn't think they were doing anything wrong because there was a demand for a drink in town, and they were supplying it. And that was all there was to it. That was a great deal of the story of Prohibition everywhere.
Sure,
that's
it was.
The reason they finally wiped it out.
Sure, it was. That's right. Could you compare and contrast the Jennings brothers, Jim and Joe?
Well, I think that Jim was really the business head. He was the fellow that really could make the operation go. But at the same time, there was a line of demarcation around, because now the Niles boys didn't deliver anything at all in Warren. The Warren boys never came down here and make any sales. And of course, it was the same thing with Youngstown. Every place had its own little lord, and they didn't tramp on each other's toes.
Would you say then that the organized crime, well, at that time it was called the Black Hand, never really got its clutches on some of the outfits in Niles?
From what I could see at the time, and this is pretty superficial because I was pretty busy with athletics, but it just didn't seem to me that they were into much else other than their selling of liquor.
Mm-hmm.
That was their business.
Mm-hmm.
That,
it was more
matter,
or less.
The matter of getting into all the other things seemed to come later.
Mm-hmm.
Probably came when the profits went down with the Prohibition being voted out.
Did Jim Jennings have any problems with the law?
No, not at all. I think everybody just, they left him alone and he left them alone. Mm-hmm. He didn't cause them any problems, and so they didn't cause him any.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there were several of the other boys around had places that were selling homebrew and corn liquor that was brewed around the valley here somewhere. I don't know where. But Jim was the fellow that had the good liquor.
After the Prohibition years, did you ever have a chance to go into the nightclub?
No, I never bothered to go. Didn't think it was the thing to do.
Yeah. Do you know of any other places similar to Jennings's nightclub that operated in the city?
No. One of the other places, of course, that was notorious there in those early years was the Jungle Inn over there near Masury. Because it was one of the biggest gambling spots between New York and Chicago.
Everybody talks about that.
It was really something.
Everybody talks. I wish I had been around just to be able to see the inside.
Well, I'd been in there, and there was only one door to get in. And as you walked in there, if you turned and looked up, the thing, there was a curved section of boilerplate up there with slots in it. And they had Tommy guns sticking in the slot so that somebody wasn't going to stop by and hijack them. Because, you know, if a bunch of fellows would walked in and they weren't protected that way, they could have walked in there and just wiped out thousands of dollars off the tables, because it was, you take one of the crap tables, were thousands of dollars laying out. There were $1,000 bills out on the table.
Incredible.
Yep. And fellows came in here from Detroit and from Cleveland, from New York and so on, came in here to gamble. It was really a big operation.
Yeah. Can you tell me anything about The police department that you remember in the early years when you came into town in 1927?
Well, the one thing was that you always had foot patrolmen walking the beat down around the old donut and up Main Street and so on. And there was just practically no crime because the boys were right there. And when anything started to happen around one of the pool rooms or any of the places down there, it was taken care of immediately because they were right there. They didn't have to wait and send a cruiser in and so on. But the only name I remember as chief was Chief Nicholas, and he had quite a record because he had not had a single unsolved murder there during the years he was there. Of course, everything was so up and above board that when anybody was going to shoot anybody, they did it out in plain sight.
Yeah. What do you remember about Nicholas? What was his personality like?
Oh, he was a real, real quiet sort of fellow, and but he was very keen on his ability to question somebody, and apparently. He must have done a good job of thinking as he did his questioning, because everybody used to talk about how sharp he was with having the right questions and so on. Mm-hmm. I've forgotten the names of most of those policemen, but I did know them in the early days, but it's been too far back.
How about Dickie Nice?
Don't remember.
Do you remember a man named Whitaker?
Yeah, remember Whitaker. Not too well, but just a little.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, those names have just slipped on me.
Oh, yeah. It'll be a while
back. It's a long time back.
Sure. Neithheimer, did you ever hear those guys?
Let's see, I've been trying to remember the name of the older fellow that was always downtown. That's gone, too.
Did you ever hear Barrett?
Yeah.
Did you ever?
Well, let's see, there was... who was the young motorcycle policeman that they had there for a long time?
Booth?
Booth, yeah.
What'd you know about Booth?
Well, one night, I don't remember what we were doing. We wasn't doing anything. There was not anything, but my wife and I and another couple. And we stopped at a stoplight, and he pulled up and put a foot out on our running board. And I asked him, what was the matter, officer? He never said a word. Just stood there and took off. I still don't know what he was doing.
Huh.
Of course, I'd heard tales about from some of the people around here with the younger set, how they'd go to one of the places. They couldn't afford Jim's liquor, generally speaking. They were over at some of the other bootleg places picking up the cheaper stuff. And then they would take off with a whole carload of them, and usually up Mason Street and across over to McDonald and so on, or out in the country. And I remember hearing one story of one group one night, about six of them, or maybe eight in the car, and here came Booth on the motorcycle. And so they started throwing liquor bottles out on the sidewalk.
So he wouldn't catch them.
Yep. Here they just bought all of that and threw it all out.
That's all right. That's something. Did you ever have a chance to know any of the mayors?
Well, yeah, knew all of them, more or less. And knew Crow, of course, from way back then.
You knew Crow?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was still around when I first came into town. But he retired and was just living retired.
What kind of guy was he?
Well, he was absolutely nuts about baseball. Just crazy about baseball. Well, that was what he was doing, and he had been a pro baseball player, you know. And he came out here and stopped and played a little here, and then he went on and played some organized ball, and then came back and... he'd made a little bit of stake, and he managed and got to be mayor, largely because he'd been so popular in town as a ball player.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that beat him was the Ku Klux Klan.
Oh yeah, they, yeah, that that happened. That mess happened just before I got up here, and it sure did tear the town apart for a while, because where everything was going along very well and so on, just all of a sudden it was just horrible.
What did you know of the Klan? Did you ever have a chance to hear anything about them when you came here?
Yeah, I knew about it from down home, because I remembered being out at Buckeye Lake one weekend, and they were having a big Klan conclave, and I think that down there in central Ohio, like it was out in Indiana, that the Klan was just kind of an underground political party and was not having any real the confrontation that they ran into here was something that just didn't happen a lot of the other places. And this got built all up out of proportion, and a bunch of outsiders were coming in to have a parade with their robes on and the hoods pulled down and so on, and the local boys decided they weren't going to have, and,
mm-hmm.
and then the thing blew up, and then the National Guard came in. I remember my wife talking about how their high school kids, where they were in the habit of, in the old building over, which is the junior high now, that they used to walk over to town for soda or something after school, and during and after that Klan trouble, as high school kids, they weren't even allowed to go downtown, and the National Guard would chase them right home, get them out of there.
Hmm.
But it took a long time to get those sores cleaned up.
It left some scars for a time.
It left a bunch of bad ones. The bad ones that it left more than anything was the breach between the Protestants and the Catholics. And Tom Murphy was the fellow that healed that more than anyone else, I think. Because Tom was the one, you know, that began organizing and then got cooperation to put on those dinners.
Tom Murphy?
Yeah. Remember, Tom used to be a reporter for the Times. And Tom fussed about this business, that it was so silly for all these people to be enemies. And so he went to the clergy of both churches and got them to get together and have a banquet and to invite the top members of their congregations to come and sit together. In other words, Tom saw to it that there was a Catholic and then a Methodist and then another Catholic and maybe a Presbyterian. He saw to it that everybody was all mixed up so that they could get to be friends instead of acting like a bunch of little children.
Where were these dinners held?
They held them at different church basements, or the I remember attending one of them at the Christian church basement, but they had them there, and they had them in alternating back and forth between a Protestant church and then a Catholic church on one year and then the other. But that straightened things out more than anything else. One of the nicest things one person ever did for Niles, I think.
Are these dinners still held?
Yeah, they still have them once a year.
What do they call those?
The Equinical.
Yeah. And this is why it was started?
Yeah, Tom Murphy was the guy that started it. He did it all on his own. Really, really worked on it. And I think he probably put a lot of his own money into sponsoring the thing in the beginning. But it sure did a lot of good.
What other scars were there?
I think one of the leftovers there was the Italians got put down again, where they had been fighting their way up and beginning to have some better jobs, and the kids were beginning to get some education, get away to school and so on. They just got slapped in the face again, and everybody got mad at everybody else. The Welsh over on the south side of town weren't going to have anything to do with any of the Italians, and the English that lived up here and on the north side and so on. It just tore the town into a whole bunch of divisions. Mm-hmm. And at that time, I still personally have my doubts that there were very many local people involved. It seems, as I remember it, that the Klan came in from outside to put on the parade, that there were very few Niles men involved. Mm-hmm. Probably very few of them even belonged.
I understand that the Jenningses, again, were amongst those who led the resistance against the Klan.
Right.
Did you ever hear of a man named Breeny Naples or Naples?
Yeah, he was quite a boxer. Very good boxer. He fought professionally and was quite good.
Mm-hmm. Was he trained by the Jenningses?
Yeah.
I didn't know he was a boxer.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he was good.
Well, I understand he was one of the leaders that day who helped to resist against the Klan.
Mm-hmm. And,
I understand he also became...
He had an awful short fuse.
Oh, he did?
Oh, yeah.
Did he become rather influential in town after the Jenningses?
Oh, not too awfully much so. Everybody knew him, but everybody just thought of him as a professional boxer, mm-hmm. and that didn't give him very much prestige, you know.
Yeah. Well, after the Jenningses faded out, did anyone come in to take their place?
I don't know, because I was away for 3 years when a lot of this happened, and by the time I got back, everything was so quiet around, and didn't seem to be anything going on. You know how quiet it is with the Jennings Hall now. And then, too, Jim's two boys didn't stay in the business. They did other things. Let's see. I believe both of them were in the soft drink business. And they distributed out of Warren.
What did Joe do? How did he differ from his brother, Jim?
Joe didn't seem to... Well, of course, he was a younger brother. And of course, as you know, the older brother was the top man, and Joe just followed along and took orders. But later on, as Prohibition took over, he did buy in and organized his own distributing outfit down in Girard, mm-hmm. which still in existence. Mm-hmm. Of course, Joe's gone now too.
Yeah. Did you know any other police chiefs?
Can't remember them at all.
Mm-hmm. How about mayors? Who do you think was the most interesting mayor this town had?
I think Christopher probably, as I remember. Most of the other fellows in between were all right, but Carmen really worked at it, and he really got a lot accomplished. Elmer Fisher did it an awful lot when he was the mayor. Elmer was the fellow that pushed for the getting the railroad up over the viaducts. Because up until that time, usually, those railroad crossings, those grade crossings, they managed to kill two or three every year.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, but Elmer really put the pressure on and got his finger on the right people in the railroad, and they came in and took their share, and Elmer worked through the state and with the governor and managed to get some state money up here, and it made an awful difference because the town was separated by those railroads cutting out across there, because people up North Main Street here was at the cross, and then come down Robbins you had to cross it, and so on and so on. And then, of course, they got the viaduct built over to the south side. It was under Elmer that they unified the city. I don't remember who was responsible in council, but whoever it was working in council in those days had to have gone along with Elmer, or he couldn't have done it alone.
Mm-hmm. Right. Do you remember any outstanding crimes or incidents that involved the police department in your years here in Niles?
Oh, I think the one that there was more talk about than anything else was the time that Marty Fleiss got shot.
Yeah.
That was one everybody talked about for a long, long time. And then Chippy just disappeared. No one knew where he was for years.
Yeah, that's interesting. It really is.
But I don't remember of any other one that... That seemed to bother people much. It didn't make headlines.
Mm-hmm. What?
One of the interesting things is that Niles has always been a city tremendously interested in its sports. And the high school team always been very important to the people. We had an awfully good playground system. And of course, at the time of the Depression, we built the stadium, and at the same time, we built the pool out at Waddell. And at that time, there during the Depression, I ran that swimming pool out there. I was out there before it opened. And an interesting side on that was that Gus Hall, who's the top man in the Communist Party, was here in Niles at the time, and about every week he managed to get a walkout out there among the WPA workers, blocking the pool and blocking the stadium getting built. We were getting awful disgusted with Gus, about ready to take him down and throw him in the river. But we ended up with an awfully nice pool there at that particular time. Didn't cost us a cent. That was all federal money and make work. Mm-hmm. And while I was the superintendent out there, people simply didn't have any money to do anything. And we made the price for coming for a swim so darn cheap. It was a nickel and a dime. And I saw to it that at least once a week, and sometimes twice a week, we put on some kind of entertainment. I had had a swim team, and we also I had a bunch of quite very good divers that we had managed to teach. And the people walked because they couldn't afford to buy gas, but people walked from way up on the other side of Mason and out in Russia Field, all the way out there, sit in the bleachers and watch those swim meets and to watch the diving shows we put on and so on. We used to feature my son when he was 3 or 4 years old. He'd get up and dive off of the high board. And they thought that was something.
Which team did you enjoy coaching most? Which sport?
Well, actually, my best sport that I enjoy is track. And I had some pretty fair track men here for a while. Dominic Match, as a sprinter, was good. And Dominic later, helped coach. He helped Joe Bassett coach. And Dominic was extremely fast. And and at the same time, I had a boy by the name of Chester Dugan, who was an excellent miler and 2 mile runner. He did very, very well in state cross-country meet. But it used to be so much fun to see, because Chester Dugan was over 6 feet tall and Dominic was about 5'5 or 5'6. And they used to jog together, and if they weren't the funniest looking couple, because Dominic took about 3 steps to his 1. But I suppose that actually I enjoy coaching basketball more than football, although it didn't make much difference. One was as much fun as the other.
Did you coach wrestling also?
Only as just fun. We didn't compete. But in class, in physical education class, The boys learned a lot of wrestling. They learned, we used to have a pool down in the old building, you know. No, we had more swimming and more life-saving going on down there.
What was the pool?
It was right behind that gym. They turned it into a storage area eventually. But we alternated with the boys and the girls using that pool. The girls would have their turn, and then we'd take the swimming down there at the time. And we taught life-saving, too. And we'd been very, very fortunate because on the girls' side, we'd had a couple of girls instructors who were excellent swimmers and excellent teachers. Martha Herlinger was one, and Martha Ransdell, who later was Martha Madden.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. She's been around till Bentown. She was married Tommy Madden.
Oh.
And she particularly was an excellent swim instructor. And both of us taught a lot of life saving that the kids knew how. And so when I opened that pool out there at Waddell, I must have had 30 or 40 boys that could have been good lifeguards. It was a great job to try to reach down and pick out 6 or 8 of them because there were so many good ones.
That's great.
Well, you probably remember some of the boys that were guards out there. Chuck Kramer was on the fire department, remember him? And Johnny Morrison, and Harry Pearson, Cuddy Sheehan, Dick Eaton. And we never even came close to having an accident or anything go wrong.
It's pretty good.
I'll start it for a minute.
Well, in school then, you taught physical education?
Yep.
And what else did you teach?
That was all. I done solid core of physical education. And the girl, whoever that happened, did the same thing. She had a solid physical education program, too.
When did you retire?
I retired in 76 from Warren.
From Warren?
Yeah. See, I was here. I left the Niles school system in 1938. And after some additional work, when I went back, I was at Braceville 2 years, and then came into Warren, and I spent the rest of my teaching life there in Warren. First coaching, and then teaching science, and then finally I became city director of audiovisual education. Eventually added a Northeast Ohio instructional film library to that.
Oh. So Harding, when you went there in 1940, you taught science? And what else?
Well, I had been coaching at Western Reserve, and then when I went to Harding, I coached cross country and track.
And then, when did you...
Let's see, in 1950, I went over into administration.
Which was with a film library and stuff.
Yeah.
That's
we started an audiovisual program.
And you retired in 76?
Yeah.
Then you knew Mr. Blakely.
Oh, my, yes.
He's the one who got me into teaching.
Is that right? He was a darn good M.
Was he?
Oh, no. That was his brother that was the M. Blakely was a nice guy.
Oh, he still is.
He was the first colored teacher hired in the morning.
Still around, too. Good man. Sharp as a pin.
Yep. He steps in there and solves a lot of problems every now and then when we got him. I remember a silly thing one night, and this is how silly some of these things happen, that at football practice at the end of the day, Smith Camel had read off a list of names of people who were to report back to the stadium at 7:30 that night after supper. And there wasn't a black name called. so they got the colored boys got all upset, and some of the hangers-on that were always there for practice every night, some of them got all upset because there weren't any colored boys, and what were they doing, establishing a separate club or something out here. And Blakely was one of them that got in there to help solve it together with a couple other people. And when they finally stopped long enough to find out what was going on, Snook Camel had been looking at the movies, and he had picked out about 8 boys who had been making horrible mistakes in the game on the preceding Friday night. And he was inviting those boys to get over there and to look at themselves and to try to get them straightened up. Every one of the colored boys had been playing really good ball. They didn't need to come. That was all there was to it, that Snook had picked the guys that needed some straightening up, and none of the colored boys were making any errors. They were playing good ball, and they weren't invited because they didn't need the extra work. But how people get off on the wrong tangent of thinking there was something funny going on, when heavens, they were the ones really were getting patted on the back because they didn't have to go. It was an extra study hall, really. That was bad there for 2 or 3 days. They were, the colored boys were going to strike. They weren't going to play on Friday night and so on.
There's one question I didn't get to ask you. Your wife, at what point in your life did you meet her? After you came to Niles?
Yeah, I met her here. Met her in the first fall I was here.
Well, how did you get to meet her?
One of the boys on the team mentioned that living up his street were 2 pretty nice girls that I should know. And so I met the other girl first, and then a few nights later, or maybe the next week, he took me up and introduced me to my wife. And the amusing thing about it was that we walk up on the porch, and he raps, and she came to the door, and he had his head down his chest, and he mumbled something or other and ran. and here we were standing there looking at each other, and I don't think either one of us were too sure of the other one's name. We were standing there. That was an auspicious start.
How interesting.
Real funny.
What was Niles generally like then in the 27 when you came here? Was it a quiet town, a busy town?
Quiet, but of course the mills were working hard. And of course everybody in town were delighted to have the sky smoky. Everybody was working when it was smoky.
Mm-hmm.
And when it cleared up, then everybody was out of work for a while, and it wasn't good. Of course, one of the bad ones I remember was that little steel strike. That was a nasty affair. That was the one where the CIO came in and were going to take over the mills and put their union in place of the old amalgamated, Amalgamated Association of Steel Workers or something of the kind.
Here in Niles.
Yeah, well, it was a nationwide one, but the CIO was setting up a new union and trying to move in and across the board get everybody in on the same blanket, whereas that amalgamated had separations with just the fellows that worked on the rolling mill, so it was a little different, but. Boy, they really brought in a bunch of goons with ball bats and rifles.
Here in town?
Oh my, yes. Evans, a lot of the executives were stayed in, and some of the rollers and so on, the top men who were in the mill and stayed right in there. And they were dropping food in by airplane. Now at the Warren Mill, they could land in there, but while they were landing and taking off, here guys with deer rifles were shooting at the planes. And the police department or the sheriff's department paid no attention, looked the other way. Didn't dare.
Isn't that interesting?
Things were bad for a while. I suffered with that a little bit because I had the best basketball team that I had during the years I was in Niles right at that time. And my team just split right down the middle of me. And fact of the matter is, I couldn't even let them all dress in the same locker room. That is, when we went to practice, I put the CIO gang over in one locker room and the FL gang down in the other locker room. And put them out on the court together, and they wouldn't pass to the others. You can't. So I ended up making two teams. I'd play one quarter, and the other team the next, just alternate. Because they wouldn't play together, they wouldn't throw the ball to each other. Any of the fellows whose fathers were in on supervision or administration at all, the other kids wouldn't have anything to do with them. Because all of this talk was going on at home, you know. Sure run a good basketball team. We had one that was good enough to have gone to the state, but they wouldn't play together.
Sad.
That was really too bad.
Were there any racial problems at the time?
No, none at all, because colored people weren't allowed in town. They used to have signs downtown about "Nigger, don't let the sun set on your back in Niles."
Where were the signs at?
Well, they were chalked up here and there, down there. Some of them just sheets of paper with stuff written on them. There were no colored people in town. First colored people in town were the Dixons. The father was a plasterer, and they had a boy by the name of Vincent who played an end with us and was pretty good. And he became a plasterer later. They were the first colored family in town.
They were accepted pretty well?
Well, they stayed by themselves and as it was said in those days, they knew their place,
mm-hmm.
you know. And they didn't bother anybody. He went ahead and did his work, and he was a good plasterer. And people, some of the contractors in town preferred him to anybody else because he was about the best plasterer around.
Well, the father of the family was a plasterer?
Yeah. And then he taught his trade to his son.
And
then he went on and was a plasterer.
All right, his son was the football player?
Yeah, Vincent was his name, Vincent Dixon.
And he played what?
He played an end. And played pretty well.
I'll be darned. And so Vince goes on to become a plasterer, and it's probably his son who's the policeman today.
I think so. Ask him.
I will. That's.
I think so.
Is Vince still alive?
I don't know. Because after I came back up here, even though we lived here, I was at Braceville and then in the Warren, and my time was taken up there. I didn't have time to fool around Niles much anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I was getting back for meets and stuff on Saturdays, you know, and so for all practical purposes, I just practically lived in Warren except come down here to sleep.
Yeah. What year or years would that be where the signs were put up?
Well, that would have been way back. That was back in the late 20s, early 30s.
Was there a showdown at the swimming pool once concerning black people being admitted to the pool?
And Mr. Wilder, the park commissioner and superintendent, got the thing settled finally by offering them some free time. And these colored kids could come over and swim for free. And I think that it was, if I remember right, it was morning that they came. And that was when we were cleaning the pool. And there weren't very many of them in town. I guess the Tabors were here by then. But anyhow, here was just a handful of them. And they were out there and they were helping my boys vacuum the pool and wash down the decks and so on, and having themselves big time helping work.
They enjoyed it, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Was there an incident where was there a police chief or somebody who told one of the black people when they were trying to use the pool that if they did use it, they would be hurt?
I don't know. Those were all rumors. You heard rumors, but I didn't ever hear anything personally.
Mm-hmm. Did you hear any of the rumors?
Oh, yeah. They were passed around a little bit. And, an awful lot of people were afraid that the black would come off in the water, I guess. But people get awfully emotional about things.
Well, that stuff wouldn't hold for 1 second today.
Oh, no.
That sign business.
No, no.
Who put the signs up? Italians or just the Protestants?
I haven't any idea.
How ridiculous.
But for years, it was a matter of that Niles had just decided they weren't going to have any colored people live in town, and that was all there was to it. And I have no idea where it came from, because it was in existence when I came.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I can't even remember. Now, young Dixon might be able to put his finger on when the family moved into town. But as I remembered, it must have been in the middle or late 30s that they came in. It seemed to me that Vincent was playing football. Well, of course, if you were taking a look on some of those darn newspapers, you probably could have picked up that name back there on some of those lineups. As I remembered, he played with my young brother-in-law, and he played sometime there in those 30s.
Is there anything?
Because I remember that Al liked this Vincent. He was an awful nice guy,
mm-hmm.
And he was a gentleman. And there isn't anybody much nicer than Louis Tabor.
Oh, you're right.
He's a gentleman.
Yes, sir. Is there anything else that you would like to include in this that I might have forgotten to ask you
about? Oh, I'll probably think of something tomorrow.
Let me know if you do. I certainly appreciate the interview.
And, good boy. You sure get foggy. Things get away from you.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get to talking about things, and all of a sudden, some of these things come flooding back. Little things here and there.
Yeah. Well, thank you a great deal.
A lot of fun to go back and think.
Yes, it is, I know.